Hello, I'm Pat Caporali. This is number 0235, the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0235. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, you'll meet science blogger Derek Muller, who has a beef with Facebook and the myriad of bogus likes his page has received. He's done a video that's gone viral. Has he heard back from Facebook?
I have not heard from Facebook directly. However, I have seen their emails to other reporters who have asked for comment. And generally, the feedback is something like, we think the likes that he was getting were genuine, somewhat. They also comment that they've changed their algorithms a lot since 2012. So their suggestion is, what happened to me in 2012 is unlikely to happen to someone now. I kind of take issue with the idea that they've changed now, so everything's fine. I mean, I'm still saddled with 80,000 useless likes on my page from 2 years ago, and they haven't removed them.
Joseph Malham is the author of John Ford, Poet in the Desert. It's a look at the life of the iconic film director.
He was a very solitary, lonely individual, and I think he was a very artistic and poetically sensitive soul. And one of the criterion for that, I think, is his solitude. I think he basically lived a life of deep solitude, and even kind of a lonely life, even though he was surrounded by friends and families, co-workers. But I think that was the catalytic agent for his greatness, was the fact that he was very, very much kind of a solitary pilgrim through life, and especially in his art.
Remembering the legendary Sid Caesar, who recently passed away. We spoke to the comic genius many years ago about his classic series, Your Show of Shows.
It was not 18 or 19 or 20 weeks or 22 weeks. It was 39 weeks, and it was an hour and a half live. And being live, I don't think people understand what live is, because some young writers come up to me and they say, how long did it take you to do the hour and a half show? Because, you know, to do a half hour now, it takes you 10, 12 hours, maybe 2 days. But then was, I said, about 90 minutes. That's how long. And it's amazing what's happened now. You know, it's made it so much easier. But listen, it was fun then. It was fun, or it was terror.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0235, was Pat Caporali, who works for the Chrysler Group's Mopar brand, covering the National Hot Rod Association drag racing. And by the way, Pat is one of the sweetest people you will ever find on this entire planet. Thank you very much, Pat, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Nelson Thabo Modupe threatened a lawsuit in January against South Africa's Eskom Electric Utilities unless the company paid him the equivalent of about $22.3 million for saving the firm that amount during the weeks of the 2010 Soccer World Cup. Now, Nelson reasoned that he had joined the Zion Christian Church just before the event and had prayed successfully to God to spare the utility from blackouts and power reductions during that period, which would have cost Eskom millions more. Nelson, open to negotiation, said he would accept a partnership in the company as a compromise. Yeah, well, you know, it's right about this time that God usually steps in. I mean, he could really test Nelson's faith right about now. Or, you know, just call him up to the office for a word or two. Just saying. Meanwhile, Trevor Robinson, age 67, of Skellingthorpe, England, was rearrested in November for violating a previous antisocial behavior order by pushing a doll-carrying baby carriage in public. He was also reportedly performing a sex act on himself. The 2009 order barred him from possessing dolls, baby carriages, or any other means in which toys might be transported. So clearly he has a history of this kind of stuff. Robinson has admitted to having a problem with dolls due to, he said, the inability to father children himself. Well, just on that last little piece of information alone, we do know the Lord works in mysterious ways. Which reminds me of Nelson from our first story. Keep that in mind, Nelson. And, you know, we have a couple of stories here under the headline of stories that just never seem to get old, especially for this program. Two of them. So, here's story number one. Following the early January winter storm in East Kingston, New Hampshire, emergency crews came to the aid of a 12-year-old girl who had a what-would-happen moment and tried to lick a metal flagpole in her front yard. Now she knows what would happen. Someone always has to learn this the hard way. And story number two, police in Los Angeles in the suburb of Harbor City were searching in February for a man suspected of stealing surveillance cameras from a home, but not before he apparently failed to distinguish between the camera, which he took with him, and the recording unit, which remained in the home and captured his face, clearly, as he removed said cameras. So, there you go. You know, they were both honest candidates for Idiot of the Day, but don't worry, we have a real winner coming up a little later on. Okay. Australian police said they arrested a 19-year-old man accused of arming himself with a chainsaw and covering his head with a flower pot to rob a store. Just picture that for a moment, will you? Yeah. Investigators say Stephen Frank Steele, age 19, had a flower pot over his head to conceal his identity and was holding a running chainsaw when he entered a 7-Eleven store in Flinders View at about 4:30 a.m. Police said the two store attendants fled to the back room when Steele lunged at them. He allegedly used the chainsaw to damage a window and several display racks when they refused his demands for money. Steele allegedly bared his buttocks to the store employees and damaged a parked car while fleeing the scene. Police said he took a bottle of soda from the store. The chainsaw, which is believed to have been stolen, was recovered from a bush near the scene, and Steele was arrested by a police officer who saw him walking down a nearby street. Steele was charged with one count of armed robbery, two counts of willful damage, one count of going armed to cause fear, one count of public nuisance, and one count of possessing suspected stolen property. Talk about a loud crime. I mean, you can't get a chainsaw with a silencer on it, can you? Yeah. And we have time for one more story in this section of the Stuff File News before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Police in Michigan said a woman accused of firing a gun into a McDonald's because her sandwich lacked bacon left her phone number with an employee. Authorities said Shanika Monique Torres, age 29, was a passenger in a car going through a McDonald's drive-thru in Grand Rapids early Monday. She left her phone number with an employee at the first drive-thru window after flirting with him. However, Torres apparently became angry at the second window when she and the other woman found their order was wrong. The police report says Torres, whose sandwich lacked the bacon she ordered, then fired a gun through the closed window of the car and a round went into the drive-through window and crossed through the building without hitting anyone. Police said employees didn't even realize that there was a shooting at first and thought a coffee pot had exploded. Torres was tracked down at her home using the phone number that she left for the worker. She was arraigned in Grand Rapids District Court on charges of carrying a concealed weapon, discharge of a firearm in a building or around a building, and felony firearms, and she was jailed in lieu of a $50,000 bond. Oh, I'll bet that employee who got her phone number wants a date now. I mean, she's just one real hot pistol, isn't she? Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest, shall we? Derek Muller is a science video blogger. He says that fake likes from click farms looking to avoid Facebook's fraud algorithms are hurting legitimate Facebook pages. Derek has a great YouTube video explaining this. I thought we'd track him down to talk to him about it, so Derek joins us on the line via Skype to Skype communications from Vancouver. Hi, Derek.
Hi, Peter. Nice to speak to you.
Nice to have you on the program with us. So I watched this video, and it certainly was an eye-opener. How did you come across what was the problem, as you see it, with Facebook?
Well, I guess, I mean, I had this experience 2 years ago where I had a Facebook page, And they sent me, you know, a $50, you know, sort of free promotion for my page on the site. So I started using it, and then I gained all these followers and realized they were kind of useless. And they've hung around with me for a couple of years. So basically, you know, the story that I told in the Facebook or in the YouTube video was just about my experience, and that's how I came to it, was just trying to run my Facebook page.
Now, since you've had since you've done this video, it's become very popular, obviously. Have you heard from Facebook?
I have not heard from Facebook directly. However, I have seen their emails to other reporters who have asked for comment. And generally, the feedback is something like, we think the likes that he was getting were genuine, somewhat. They also comment that they've changed their algorithms a lot since 2012. So their suggestion is, what happened to me in 2012 is unlikely to happen to someone now. I've seen those sorts of comments coming out of Facebook reportedly. My issue, like, I kind of take issue with the idea that they've changed now, so everything's fine. I mean, I'm still saddled with 80,000 useless likes on my page from 2 years ago, and they haven't removed them. But these are profiles that never interact with anything I post, and that much is clear. So basically, they are just dead weight, and I would love for Facebook to get rid of them or for them to provide me the tools to delete them as I see fit. But I can't. So I'm kind of stuck with them.
As you've described what they've said to reporters who have asked them the question, is their answer any different from what you came across when you asked them yourself?
I never asked Facebook. Frankly, the organization strikes me as impenetrable. I'm not sure who I would go to or how I would approach them. But I know a number of people have contacts within Facebook on my Twitter network, and they've all been getting back to me saying that they've talked to their friends at Facebook, and these are, you know, roughly the words that Facebook is saying. So as far as I can see, Facebook is not sort of releasing an official statement. And I think that that's probably wise. You know, if I were in Facebook's position, I wouldn't want to give this any more attention than it already has. So I think they don't want to fuel the fire, and I understand that.
Are you surprised by the amount of people who have seen your video? Although you have a lot of videos and you do have a large following, but are you surprised by the reaction that this one is getting?
I'm not really surprised. You know, I make a lot of videos that get over 1 million views, but this topic in particular I know is of general applicability. And the fact that the kind of behavior that we're seeing, which I think is really not genuine, and it's so easy to demonstrate, I think that's led a lot of people to really question it. And it makes for a very shareable video, because there's a lot of people out there who are paying Facebook right now. And that was my main motivation for making this video. You know, it's to say, I don't want anyone else to have this bad experience that I had. So this is my experience. You know, be careful.
Are you worried, since they haven't come back and said, yes, this is a problem, this is incorrect, and they actually have been on the defensive, are you worried that they might want to now come after you?
I don't really think that they'll want to come after me. And I think that the things that I'm saying are based in evidence. You know, I'm not trying to make broad sweeping claims. I'm not saying that Facebook is committing fraud or that they're behind these fake likes. I guess what I am saying is, it appears to me that there are a significant number of fake profiles and fake like activity which happen on Facebook. I'm saying that they also benefit financially from that. I think these are somewhat uncontestable statements. The question is, how deep does it go? You know, how much money have they made essentially from clicks that were not genuine? That's a question I can't answer. Only they have the data to reveal that. But I know that they must have some sense of the scale of the problem, and I don't think that they're being forthright with it just yet. So I'm hoping to see them act on this. You know, I want this to be a trigger for change. I'd love to see them fix up their processes.
Okay, so if the problem is a process that needs to be fixing, as you say, and Facebook isn't involved with these fake likes directly, those who are doing the fake likes, what are they getting out of this?
Well, there's a number of things. I mean, there's a big kind of underground market for likes. You know, there's all these click farms which have been set up in developing countries, and you can pay them if you want your page to look impressive, or if you want your Twitter account to look impressive, or even your YouTube page. So there are places you can go to ask people essentially to click a mouse button for you, and you can pay for that service. The reason why it's so problematic with Facebook is that you get stuck with these followers forever, essentially, as long as the sort of click is done in a clever enough way that it avoids Facebook's fraud detection algorithms. And in a way, that is even part of the problem, because by trying to avoid Facebook's fraud detection, these click farms are having to click on other pages, things that they haven't been paid to like. In fact, there are some people who have come out in a news report and said that is correct. That's what these click farms do. They're quite sophisticated with their methods. You know, they don't want to be found out. So the price of doing business is, in addition to clicking the sort of client site to raise its profile, they also click random sites just to make it much more difficult to spot this kind of fraudulent activity.
One of the things you brought up in your video is the fact that you looked at some of the places, as you just mentioned, that these click farms or these fake likes go to as pages that they like, and it's a very a variety of pages that they go to that don't seem to make any kind of sense, correct?
Sure. I mean, I think what these likers are doing, and this is just conjecture on my part, but I think they're just clicking the easiest thing that it is to click, and that just makes sense. So when you advertise your page, that gets featured across the site. So if you are someone and you are, you know, clicking on some fake client site because you're being paid for it, what other things are easy to like? Well, the things that are popping up in your sidebar. It's great. You don't even have to look at it. You don't have to search for anything. And it's totally kind of random. You know, it's whatever Facebook's serving to you. It's perfect. So, you know, that's exactly what I would do if I were working for a click farm. I would just be clicking those ads as they come up.
Now, I have to admit, I was not terribly familiar with your work before I saw this Facebook video, but now I am. So for those who are not, tell us about your page and the things that you do, because you are a science video blogger.
Yeah, that's correct. I make a page called Veritasium on YouTube, and basically I just try to explore any kind of science which is interesting to me. So I've flown a water jetpack. I have created a levitating barbecue using electromagnetic induction. I found that dropping a slinky in slow motion looks remarkable. So basically I like to delve into all sorts of different science and educate the public about pretty cool things that are happening in our world.
And what is your background, and how did you get started in doing this?
Well, I was Australian-born, Canadian-raised, and I moved back to Sydney about 10 years ago. I got a PhD in physics education research, and then I started making videos about science using the knowledge that I'd learned in my degrees. And so basically I work as a teacher and as a filmmaker and as a TV presenter in Australia.
While watching the videos, all I kept thinking is, where were teachers like you when I was in school, when I was, you know, zoning out?
The right teacher does make all the difference. I really think that is true. So, you know, hopefully I can reach more kids and show them that science is pretty awesome. It's not just some boring stuff in a textbook.
And bringing it back full circle, what's the thing you would like to teach Facebook the most, and do you think they'll respond?
What would I like to teach Facebook the most? I guess I think that they already know the problem. You know, I feel like the problem needs to become more widely known. So I guess the best thing I can do is raise awareness amongst the public. And so, you know, I feel like I'm doing that now, which is good. My sense is that Facebook would like to diversify into a variety of different apps so that their revenue doesn't just come from the one platform. And I think they're hoping to do that fast enough that, you know, before anyone realizes all this fraudulent activity has boosted all of their revenue thus far, that they have other streams of revenue coming in, and then, you know, their company is secure. At least that's what I would want to do if I were Facebook. So for me, I just want to get the word out about what I see as a significant problem, and I want to stop, you know, other business owners from wasting money like I did. You know, I spent $1,500 on what is essentially just a lead weight. So my education is really not of Facebook. I think they know. I think they understand what's going on. It's of the general public.
Hypothetically, since you spent $1,500, would you ever think of being even more proactive than just doing a video, perhaps doing a class action or small claims court case?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people have asked me that. I'm not really interested in getting into legal battles. My fundamental interest is in educating the world about everything, and I don't have a lot of, you know, interest in maintaining this kind of line with Facebook. If someone else wants to do a class action lawsuit, I'd be more than happy to provide my data. But I'm not going to be spearheading a charge here. I'm not interested in any kind of, you know, financial retribution or anything on that.
Well, it certainly is an interesting video. Not only that is an interesting video, but also your regular page where you have a variety of science experiments. It's fascinating indeed. Derek, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Hey, it's my pleasure.
Science video blogger Derek Muller. If you're not familiar with his amazing science work, you have to check out his YouTube page, Veritasium. I guarantee you, you'll probably end up spending hours there. It's a lot of amazing stuff on that page. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0235, and you'll find the links to Derek's page and also links to the Facebook commentary called Facebook Fraud.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
This is your safe haven from the hard news of the day. The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio for your happy place.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of John Ford, Poet in the Desert. Plus, we have a retro interview. We look back with a chat we had several years ago, back to 1993, with the legendary Sid Caesar, who unfortunately passed away just last week. But right now, more Stuff File news here on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, the Michigan State Trooper set up the sting for a man who was advertising on a gay website that he wanted to trade sexual favors for illegal substances. You know, drugs. They set up an attractive profile on the site, which, sure enough, attracted the suspect, Michael Strong, age 37. They set up a meeting at a hotel, which was wired with cameras and microphones, and they say Strong showed up with the promised drugs, and he was recorded telling undercover officers what he was going to do in exchange for them. Strong was wearing his police uniform. Yep. He's an officer in Prairieville Township. He was arrested and charged with a delivery of amphetamines, which is a felony, as well as felony use of a firearm. That would be his service pistol. And you know, he has only been out of the basic police academy for 10 months. I guess apparently undercover stings aren't covered until the advanced classes. Yeah. A cop going to jail because he was willing to trade drugs for gay sex. Oh, prison's going to be very interesting for him, don't you think? Yeah. Firefighters in Chula Vista, California, were assisting crash victims when a highway patrol officer told them to move their vehicles out of traffic. Fire engineer Jacob Gregoire decided to continue helping crash victims instead. So the officer handcuffed him and put him in the back of his cruiser for a half an hour. We are in the middle of patient care with patients on the freeway, and we are trying to protect our scene, and they put him in handcuffs at this time and are walking away with him, radioed another firefighter to his dispatcher. A firefighter's union said in a statement that the fire vehicle was positioned to protect rescue workers and crash victims. A former CHIP officer said it's legal to order a firefighter to move his vehicle. Okay, now for the record, I love police officers, but it's pinheads like these last two stories that give those who serve and protect a bad name. Yes, it's legal to ask a firefighter to move his vehicle, but is it right? Yeah. Anyway, would you like fries with that? How about some heroin? Police in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania say a drive-thru employee at a McDonald's was caught selling heroin in a Happy Meal box. Authorities allege the suspect would know when someone wanted heroin because they'd come to the drive-thru and say, "I'd like to order a toy." The customer would then be told to proceed to the first window where they would be handed a Happy Meal box containing heroin. This according to Mike Manco, a spokesman for the district attorney's office. He said a box included 10 stamp bags of heroin along with a Happy Meal toy. A 26-year-old woman was arrested. Gee, you'd think they'd give them the Happy Meal too, as opposed to just the toy. That's all I'm saying. Brings new meaning to their latest slogan, a whole new way to love McDonald's. Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Regina Hill, age 48, is running for the District 5 seat on the Orlando, Florida City Council. She says her past makes her more qualified than four-term incumbent Daisy Lynham to represent the district, which is struggling with high levels of crime, unemployment, and homelessness. That past is revealed in her rap sheet, which includes 21 arrests for charges including drug offenses, DUIs, and writing bad checks. She's received clemency 5 years ago, which is the only reason Hill can run for office as a convicted felon. Hill sees the focus on her criminal past as a distraction. "My work speaks for me, not my past. I'm doing great things in District 5," she said. "This is nothing but a smear campaign." At least some voters are backing her. She's paid for her crime in her past, and she wants to serve the people, one resident said. Hill already has served the people, by sitting in jail, of course. But hey, if they want to vote her in, that just reinforces what I've always said. The great thing about democracy is that the population always, always gets the government it deserves. Anyway. On to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Joseph Malham is the author of John Ford, Poet in the Desert, which looks at the troubled life of the legendary film director. Ford won 6 Academy Awards, and he was the man who made John Wayne the Duke. Joseph joins us on the line from Illinois to talk about his book and the famed director. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for the invitation.
Thanks for being on the program with us. Right off the bat, I just want to ask about the subtitle of your book. Why is it Poet in the Desert?
Well, I think that Ford is invariably associated with a geographic locale, which is Monument Valley, about 30,000 acres in northern Arizona, southern Utah, which is immediately associated with him. It's one of the most magnificent spaces in the American West, where he filmed a lot of his movies. But I think on a deeper level, it speaks to Ford's, basically the core of the man, which I think was a very solitary, lonely individual, and I think he was a very artistic and poetically sensitive soul. And one of the criterion for that, I think, is solitude. I think he basically lived a life of deep solitude and even kind of a lonely life, even though he was surrounded by friends and families, co-workers. But I think that was the catalytic agent for his greatness, was the fact that he was very, very much kind of a solitary pilgrim through life, and especially in his art.
He made some of the greatest films ever, from Stagecoach to The Searchers to The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance to The Grapes of Wrath, and the list goes on and on and on. But as you just described him, do you think someone like him could survive in today's world?
Probably not. Ford, even though it was the height of this, what they called the studio system, where everybody was basically a cog in these gigantic wheels, Ford was too much of an independent operator. He worked outside the system, and I think that it worked well in the time when all these great directors were going off in their own directions, independence and everything. But I think that today Ford would have been a complete outcast, a complete pariah in terms of the structure of Hollywood and how films are made today. And I think that even that was sort of the writing on the wall when we saw the direction Hollywood was going in the late '60s. And he basically said, I really don't fit in. I don't want any part of this, which accounts for, you know, much of the reason why he got out of the film business when he did.
I mentioned in the introduction that he is the man who made John Wayne the Duke. They had a special relationship. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it was it grew out of a couple of things. It grew out of Ford's need, despite the fact that he always built this curmudgeonly, hard-bitten facade as the Pappy, as the coach, as the admiral. It belied a need for him to be needed, and so we had people like Victor McLaughlin, Henry Fonda, George O'Brien during the silent period, who really looked up to Ford. But when he found, when he discovered John Wayne, who was basically just a gopher on a set in the late 20s, it was like a man in the moment met, because Duke, despite the great heroic proportions of his persona, was really kind of fragile too, because he was a product of a broken home, a mother who didn't love him, a father who was just kind of a ne'er-do-well and a failure. And so I think that because Ford's own family relations were so dysfunctional, and Duke's were, they saw in each other kind of the father and the son the other one never had. And it really, that dynamic never changed. And even when Wayne was in his 60s and as international superstar, he always remained deferential and childlike around Ford. It was always like father and son, but also master and disciple. And that never changed. So it was a beautiful relationship, but it was also fraught with its own kind of tincture of dysfunction and tensions, too, that frequently tended to boil over.
There have been so many books written about John Ford. What made you decide to add your book to the list?
Well, I think that I realized that going in, Peter, and I realized that it's almost like writing a book on Lincoln. What more can be said about Ford, especially when I'm in the shadow of such, you know, luminaries like Joseph McBride and Tad Gallagher and Scott Eyman. But what I really tried to see, I tried to see it through a different lens, and this is the effect of Ford's deeply felt religious beliefs. Not only his sense of myth and history, especially American history, but also his religious beliefs. And it's present in almost all of his films, not just the cowboys and the westerns, but in all of his films. He deals with family, he deals with the sacredness of the meal, but mostly is what in Catholic parlance is called the communion of the saints, which is almost present in almost every Ford film, meaning that the dead are always present. There's always a bond between the living and the dead. And you can look at all of his films from the silent period onward, and that very strong bond between the living and the dead, which is a very deeply spiritual and mystical theme. It's and I tried to explore that a little bit, and I don't think that really has been explored too much. Basically, his films were called memory plays, where you're always remembering the past. But I sort of posit the theory that actually it was the dead had been brought into the present and are always there. And the family goes on, parents were always there with us. And that's kind of the tack that I took, was to poke and prod around that a little bit more than the other biographers did.
This is not the first book that you've written, but as you've just described your reasoning for writing and delving into John Ford, it's also not the first book that has a religious background to it, to a certain degree.
Well, my first book was about four martyrs of the Nazi death camps, and three men and one woman who actually put themselves in harm's way in defense of the Jewish people and in defiance of National Socialism. So I was already familiar with the language of faith and spirituality, and being a passionate devotee of film and loving film as much as I do, I basically just transferred the template and tried to write a unique and original book, but at the same time, trying to preserve some of the same signposts on the paths I'd already been down. And it was fun. It was a great, great journey.
In putting together this book, John Ford, Poet in the Desert, did you have an opportunity to talk to any of the people who may have at some point come into contact with John Ford, or perhaps any family members?
Well, like Betty White said on her 90th birthday, she said, if I want to talk to any of my friends, I have to use a Ouija board. And I sort of felt the same way, because everybody associated with Ford is pretty much gone. They're gone by now. The only people living are Maureen O'Hara, and she does not give interviews, and Shirley Temple, who did not give interviews. for the last several years of her life, and obviously we lost her just last week. So I had to deal primarily with the archives, the Ford Archives and the Lilly Library, and letters, correspondence. But I also made contact with Ford's grandson, Dan Ford, who was the first one to write a major biography of his grandfather. And he was very gracious, gave me a great deal of assistance. But aside from that, everyone else is pretty much gone.
Being a John Ford fan, putting this book together, did you look at his films any differently? And by that I mean, do you have a favorite John Ford film, and did that change in doing this research and writing this book?
Yeah, I always thought that The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, it always looked like, you don't sound old enough to remember the old TV westerns.
Absolutely.
Do you remember like Rawhide, Maverick, and all that stuff?
Absolutely.
There was kind of a tinny, cheap feel to The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. Basically, it looked like an old episode of what was it called with Chuck Connors, the Rifleman.
The Rifleman.
It was cheap sets and black and white, and it didn't look like a Ford film. Until I realized that seeing it through a lens after time and doing all this research, realized that Ford basically was kind of looking at the myth of the West as kind of as basically that's what it is. It's a myth, and it was sort of not destroying it, but showing that it's all kind of just passing. It's not. There's nothing really substantial to heroics, and there's a great deal of lies and things like that. So I started to see Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. It's kind of like a Don Giovanni, a really dark, grim, existential take on a mythology and the mythology of the West. And I thought, boy, this is brilliant. This is deeper stuff than I had ever expected from him. And so I began to see that movie different, and that led to sort of a recalibration of my appreciation of his other films and seeing recurring motifs and themes and symbology. So yes, that did, long-winded answer to your question, yes, that did happen.
You mentioned earlier how his religion always seemed to permeate the films that he worked on, and you also touched on Maureen O'Hara, which leads me to bring up his Irish background. Is that something that's always predominant in his films?
It was. He made several trips to Ireland, and he was somewhat involved in the 1920s when there was the Civil War going on and very bloody, dark time in Ireland. And that sort of changed him. It sort of turned him into a more of a left-leaning radical, and that began to shade his politics. So he through his whole life, he remained fully committed, totally committed to not only the cause of Irish nationalism, but Irish culture. Themes of Irish literature and heritage like family, community, faith, injustice, oppression, and that dedication to his Irish heritage and the pain and suffering, I think it colored a lot of his non-Irish films. And he made, you know, so many films dealing with Ireland, but even in the other ones, that Irish sense of justice and all these great rich themes filtered into his works too.
The book is called John Ford, Poet in the Desert. It's written by Joseph Malam. And Joseph, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
My pleasure, Peter. Thank you so much. It was great talking with you.
Joseph Malam, author of John Ford, Poet in the Desert. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0235, and you'll find links to Joe's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. After years of reading legal publications, I've seen lawyers blame car crashes on just about every excuse imaginable. However, a lawsuit involving a crash in California has brought to light a new excuse that may be the most bizarre ever. According to an accident report compiled by the California Highway Patrol, a 63-year-old driver fell asleep at the wheel while driving north on Highway 1. He crossed into the oncoming lane and hit a man riding his bike on the shoulder. Sadly, the man died. The driver, who had just bought the car 10 days before the crash, admitted to falling asleep, but here's where it gets strange. He said that the reason he nodded off was because of the new car smell. Let's be fair, a long investigation found no mechanical problems with the car at all, but the automaker is now being sued for that crash. No matter what the verdict turns out to be in this case, we all wind up paying for lawsuits like this. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that puts a smile on your face and a skip in your step. Please avoid skipping if you are driving.
And still to come on the program, we'll remember the late Sid Caesar, who passed away just last week, a comic genius if there ever was one. We'll also have an idiot of the day coming your way, but a couple more Stuff File news stories right here, right now, on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Right here we have two stories we put together. I'll explain why they're together later. Number one, in December, thieves in Wicklow, Ireland raided a convent's field at the Dominion Farm and Ecology Center, stripping it of its entire crop of Brussels sprouts. A nun at the farm said the sisters were devastated to miss out on the lucrative market of high-end Christmas dinners. And story number two, in January, Walmart in China recalled its five-spice donkey meat sold in some locations because the popular snack, yes, it's a snack, was found to be tainted with fox meat. Like, that's worse? Okay. On the surface, these are two stories that don't sound like they really matter in life. It's all a matter of acquired tastes, I guess. Yeah. And finally, Daniel Severn, age 27, pleaded guilty to burglary in England's Hull Crown Court in December for trying to enter a home through the roof, but getting trapped upside down in the bathroom. He dug his phone out of his pocket, but it fell into the toilet, and he remained hanging for an hour and a half until a resident arrived and found him. Yeah, some people are just too stupid for crime. Yeah. Anyway, we're going to remember Sid Caesar in just a moment, but I want to remind you, first of all, the National Eating Disorders Association is having their 27th annual National Eating Disorders Awareness Week. It runs from February 23rd to March the 1st. Now, you can find out more information about eating disorders and the upcoming week at their website, which is nationaleatingdisorders.org. And I'll let Winona Judd tell you her story.
Hi, this is Winona Judd, and you probably don't think of me as a person with an eating disorder, but here's my truth. Eating disorders are real, and they are not just about losing weight. Eating disorders are the way you feel about your body and the way you treat yourself. For years, I have been a compulsive overeater, and it wasn't until its effects threatened my health, my family, and my career that I finally reached out for help. Recovering from an eating disorder is possible, and I'm living proof. But you have to take the first step, so I urge you to visit nationaleatingdisorders.org.
This is the Stuff File.
It's time for another retro interview with a celebrity that is no longer with us. This time around, it's a chat I had back in February of 1993, and it's with someone who left us just recently. Comedy legend Sid Caesar. Caesar was the writer, actor, and all-around showman who profoundly influenced American comedy from the early days of television and beyond. Born Isaac Sidney Caesar, the actor was best known for the television series Your Show of Shows in the 1950s. That show first brought together the seminal comedy team of Caesar, Carl Reiner, Howard Morris, and Imogene Coca, as well as breaking the writing careers of future comedy luminaries such as Mel Brooks, Neil Simon, Larry Gelbart, and Woody Allen, just to name a few. He wrote two autobiographies, Where Have I Been? And Caesar's Hours, which touched on his struggles with alcoholism and barbiturates. We had a chance to talk to him back on February 18th, 1993. Here is part of that conversation now. Going back to the golden age of TV, sir, when you first started, a lot of people are remembered for what they did in television, but the one thing I guess people think about you is the fact that you were a pure television performer. You didn't come from radio like some of the others. You didn't come from films before like some of the others. You were pure to the medium of television.
Well, yeah, I mean, but I played...
You did Broadway before.
I beg your pardon?
You did Broadway before, right?
Yes, I did Broadway before, and I worked some nightclubs before, and it goes all the way back, you know, it was a medium where you had to do it. It was like doing it in the age of King Arthur's court. I mean, everything was stone, you know. I mean, when we split the screen, we thought it was like splitting the atom, you know.
Was part of the excitement the fact that you really didn't have a guidebook to go with beforehand?
No, there's nothing to go by. I mean, there were no shows, you know. And the main thing was we had to make do everything. You know, there were no teleprompters, there were no cue cards, you know. You had to learn it. You had to do it.
I had the chance to go through your book, which you wrote about a decade ago, called Where Have I Been?
Yes.
And one thing you mentioned throughout the course of the book is one of the most important things in that era was the writing.
Oh, absolutely. I was very, very blessed.
You had some of the greatest writers.
A big part?
You had some of the greatest writers of all time on one show, or in two shows, basically.
Yes.
Tell us some of the writers you had.
It was Neil Simon, and there was Mel Brooks, Larry Gelbart, Allen.
Woody Allen?
Woody Allen, yes. We were all sitting in the same room, you know, and there were many other writers that were just as great, you know. Aaron Rubin, many, many of them. And they've all gone to tremendous, they're all geniuses, you know.
There was a lot of pressure, though, in doing a show like that. Each week you had to come up with a brand new show.
Yeah, and it was not 18 or 19 or 20 weeks or 22 weeks. It was 39 weeks, and it was an hour and a half live. And being live, I don't think people understand what live is because, you know, some young writers come up to me and they say, how long did it take you to do the hour and a half show? Because, you know, to do a half hour now, it takes you 10, 12 hours, maybe 2 days. But then was, I said, about 90 minutes. That's how long. And it's amazing the what's happening now, you know. It's made it so much easier. But listen, it was fun then. It was fun or it was terror.
In your first show, you started with Imogene Coca, your show of shows, and then you segued into another show with Nanette Fabre.
Yes.
You had a pretty good run on network television.
Yes. We were around for about 9 years.
Did you ever feel during that time that, you know, how are we going to keep putting this out week after week?
It's, and to say the least, it's tiring.
I can imagine.
Yes, it was quite a feat. I mean, not only the physical, but the intellectual, you know, putting out shows, as you say, every week, and trying to be different, and trying to search for new ideas, new categories to go into, you know, different ways of doing things. You know, we did, silent movies, we did foreign movies, we did the satire of the regular movies, and we did pantomimes, we did everything that we could think of, you know, which was a wonderful just a place to experiment, you know. And we did, and some of it paid off, some of it didn't.
What do you think of television today?
Television today?
Yeah.
Some of it is marvelous, and some of it is, you know, so-so.
What do you watch today when you watch current popular television?
Well, I watch mostly, I watch PBS, A&E, the entertainment, A&E.
Arts and Entertainment?
TLC, yeah. Arts and Entertainment. And I like PBS, you know, I watch CNN. And if there's good sports on, I watch that also. And I watch C Channel.
Mm-hmm.
And but I don't watch too much television. I never watch television during the day, except if there's a game.
Now, I know you've done some work in the last little while with Comic Relief. That's where some people may have had a chance to see you. I've known you've done some work with Comic Relief.
Yes.
And that's where people sometimes get a chance to see you. But as far as being regularly in television, do you miss it?
Well, in a way, no, not really, no. If something came along that would be good, okay. But it's to work that hard now. And it's much easier now. Really.
I was told that at one point you were interested or you were considered for playing the role of coach on Cheers. Is that correct?
The coach?
Yeah.
No, I was supposed to play the bartender.
That's right, the bartender, the one that was played by Nick Colasanto. You were going after that role at one point?
No, I just went up to talk to them. That's all.
Mm-hmm. So at that point, you would have been interested in getting back into regular TV.
Yes, in a way, surely. Yes.
Do you keep abreast of ideas and shows that are going on in the future in case there's something you might be interested in doing?
Well, you know, everything. I mean, I'm not looking to make a new career now. You know, but the main thing is enjoy life. The main thing is to appreciate life. You know, people who walk around, you know, I got to do this, I got to do that. If you can just sit down and appreciate life, that's all. Understand what the gift that you've been giving and the gift that you've got, you know. Well, that's wonderful.
That's a very philosophical point, and
well, you have to be.
I guess people who have known you for only your career and what they see publicly would be surprised about some of the things they can get a chance to read about in your book, Where Have I Been?
Yes.
Was that a revelation? Were people actually surprised when you came up with this book and said, this is what's been going on? I mean, you talk about alcoholism and problems that you've had and in your personal life and how you've done things. You did an entire film in New Zealand that you weren't even aware of. That, I mean.
Well, you know, it's what I was, something I had to go through, and thank God I got through it. Mm-hmm. And the main thing is you get through it. You know, if you have to do something, you know, you can't keep blaming everything on other people. You can't keep saying, oh, it's because of them. They did it. And look at them. And look what they did to me. You got to take some responsibility for yourself. Once you find that out, that you have responsibility for yourself, and you start to make friends with yourself.
I understand that.
You make friends with yourself, then you're on your way to having a little happiness.
I understand that the beginning of the realization of the problems that you have actually took place in Canada.
Yes, exactly right. It was in Regina.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and they were very, very nice to me there. Yes, I went right to the hospital there. That was the first time, and that's what started it. Yes, that was the recovery.
There have been plays written about. I mean, there's the film My Favorite Year. There's the Broadway play Laughter on the 23rd Floor.
Yes, yes.
You must feel rather honored to be remembered.
Very much so. I mean, I'm a very, very lucky man. You know, to have worked with these kind of these talents. You know, and I'm talking about everybody. You know, I was a very lucky man, and I still am.
Do you keep in contact with those most talented people who were with you on that show?
Of course, yes. We talk to each other. You know, when there's no. We know each other. We spend many, many hours and many, many horrible hours and many, many funny hours together.
Before I let you go, is there anything that we can look forward to from you that would be new? Or are there any ways of people getting a hold of old shows of yours?
What I'm going to be doing. I'm going to be putting there's a lot of people have been asking where the shows are, you know.
Exactly, yeah.
And I think I'm going to start to put some shows out, you know, for video.
Mm-hmm. Do you own the shows yourself?
Yes, I do.
A very smart move. A lot of people didn't do that in the past.
Yes, there's 450 hours of them.
and you have them all, and they will soon be available to video?
Yes. Yes, we're working on a deal now.
Well, I look forward to seeing those shows, and I thank you for talking with us for the brief moments we've been able to have with you this evening.
Right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
That was part of an interview from February 18th, 1993, with the legendary Sid Caesar, a comic genius. Sid died recently on February 12, 2014, at the age of 91.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about out of racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. Time for one more item, and of course, you know what that would be, boys and girls. Yes, it's time for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
Jerry Pancoast, age 42, was arrested on at least four charges after a high-speed chase through Iowa's Polk and Jasper counties in January, following an alleged shoplifting of tweezers and an eyebrow pencil, not even taken by Pancoast, but by his companion. Pancoast drove at 100 miles per hour, even on deflated tires and three rims that eventually caused his truck to catch on fire. The episode started as a simple theft case, said the arresting officer, until Pancoast abruptly took off. He later explained that he panicked because he knew that there was already arrest warrants against him, but a subsequent search turned up none. Now, why would someone run from police because he believes he's wanted by cops, only to drive so fast on only rims that his truck catches on fire, and to top it off, there are no warrants for his arrest? One reason, and one reason only, he's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0235. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0235. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Today's broadcast could be heard directly in your home, car, or wireless device, or on your computer, so you can listen on an outpatient basis. For those of you hearing this show directly inside your head, please adjust your medication.